So last week I did say we want to do something a little bit different in our online gathering this morning. I'm always on the lookout for ways to mine enduring wisdom traditions, to look for ideas that have endured. At the risk of using a very contemporary illustration for a much older idea, I'm looking for the Beatles songs of wisdom. You know, I'm looking for the tunes that we keep singing. And because I think those are clues about what sort of things are worth continuing to explore and what sort of things sort of rise above the trend. And goodness knows, you know, I think we need to keep finding ways that of thinking about the world and looking at the world and living in the world that sort of point us to the deeper water, that point us to things that consistently help us connect with the mystery that's beyond us. And not the least of the reasons for that is that we have to navigate life as wisely as we can. And sometimes we kind of can blow that off, but sometimes I think we really feel it. We feel a push and shove of it. And when we watch the world trying to navigate something like a global health emergency, when we watch our own province and culture trying to do the same thing, we have our own households trying to do the same thing, I think those are moments where we really feel it, where we feel like, you know, a little more wisdom would be great. And it's not magic, but it is something we can seek out, you know? And so this is sort of part of that. As I mentioned last week, that search for those intersections of ancient wisdom and contemporary life have led me to a couple of different sources that at first might seem to not have very much in common. The first of those is the book of Ecclesiastes. In the Christian canon, in the Bible, Christian Bible, that would be the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. It's a Hebrew book in that collection. And the other was The Science of Psychology. And I could have chosen to just sort of talk about those ideas that I encountered there, and I expect they'll keep showing up, and so that'll probably kind of happen. But what I wanted to do this morning was sort of help us stir our imaginations a bit more by having Tim and I do this in a form of a conversation. And the conversation will be between the person whose story is told in Ecclesiastes and sort of a hypothetical psychologist. And I guess I could end up offending quite a range of people with a creative exercise like this, ranging from the folks who don't like to have sacred texts approached in imaginative ways to the people who either think psychology is the new gospel, which is a whole interesting idea that our mental health practitioners are the new priest class in the Western world. We should explore that some morning because I think there's something there to really dig into. But some folks might sort of take offense because they feel like psychology isn't something you should sort of play fast and loose with. It's, you know, super important. Or people who think it's a pseudoscience, you know, it doesn't really qualify at all, so got a real range there. And what I put in my notes is, oh well, ideas aren't pizza. You can't make everybody happy. So we're going to dive in anyway. For my part, I'll be pleased if this helps us all think one new thought about how to live as wisely as we can in changing times. So here's how we're going to do this. I'm going to offer us a little bit of a kind of background as a sort of narrator, and then I'm going to switch gears to reading the part of the psychologist. Tim has graciously agreed to read the part of the ancient wise one. So I think that's all as it should be. Our characters are Koheleth and Sigi. Koheleth is the Hebrew pseudonym for the king whose story is told in Ecclesiastes. We don't know who the actual historical figure is. He's identified in the text as a son of David and the king of Jerusalem. He's actually often just simply called the teacher. In lots of English translations, the word Koheleth is actually it's actually sort of a rhyming word with a word that means the one who addresses the assembly. And so that's kind of where the name comes from. And so that's the character Tim's going to read. Sigi, the character I'm going to read, is a sort of an archetypal 21st century psychologist. I was going to call the character Will, because the two founding fathers of psychology, one was Wilhelm and one was William, and I thought that'd be kind of, you know, oblique and meaningless to anyone who hadn't read that history and fun for me. But the character we know when it comes to the founding of the science of psychology, the character we know best is Sigmund Freud. And so I'm not a Freud character in any sort of mirroring or imitative way, but I thought I'd mess with his name. So I'm not Freud, I'm Sigi. And just one final disclaimer about the writing. I have a very skilled writer acquaintance and a former creative colleague who liked to say that you could always tell when you were in the presence of bad religious theater because you could tell how the play was going to end shortly after it began. And my goal in the following has been, in part, to just avoid that particular pitfall. So we'll see how it goes. All right. So the setting is Sigi's place, and here we are at my place. And I've invited Koheleth over for a friendly chat, and that's where we begin. Well, this is pretty interesting. I read your book, but I never imagined that we would get to meet. So thanks for being willing to come over, especially, you know, these days there's lots of reasons to stay home.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm glad it worked out. And thanks for reading the book. Did you make it all the way through? A lot of folks don't.
Yeah, well, I read the whole thing. And more than once, I can say to my credit, but I can appreciate how people might think they don't need to read to the end. You kind of shoot your bolt in the first paragraph with that meaningless, everything is meaningless opening, you know?
Yeah, my ghostwriter felt the same way. But when it came down to it, I was paying the bill, so it stayed in.
Yeah. Well, can I just ask, like Cole, what's with the pseudonym? I mean, it seems like you're part of a pretty well-known political family, a dynasty, really, and there haven't been that many kings of Jerusalem.
Well, you know, when it comes to publishing, sometimes you have to make compromises on things like titles, cover art, that sort of thing. Some of what I refer to in the book was still current when I wrote it, even though I had already stepped down. So the publishers were concerned about not getting dragged into a bunch of debilitating litigation. But they also knew it would sort of intrigue people to try and guess who the real author was. So this is how it ended up. All in the past now, of course, but it still gets reprinted under that name.
At least it still gets reprinted.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear you. Lots of my own publishing is in magazines, and these days a lot of it's online, and the editors have a lot of sway in those environments. Still, you know, it feels like good work to do, and I'm glad I get to do it.
And now you sound like you're summing up my book.
Yeah, I guess, right? A lot of what you reflect on is how important it is to like what we do and enjoy what we have. And you use pretty encompassing language for your own experiences and explorations, a kind of a, I've seen it all, I've done it all, I've read all the literature. I mean, really pretty sweeping. And I know that you faced your own version of threats of impending doom. They might not have been from disease or famine, although I think those might have been part of the story too, but they were certainly from surrounding kingdoms that wanted to wipe you out. So how do you feel like some of your conclusions that you've reached apply to the present global circumstances, which, you know, we might feel are unique?
Well, a lot of what I was trying to get at in the book, this idea that we only have so much control, only so much agency. It's not that we don't have choices to make, we do. If we're rich or powerful, we probably have more choices available to us. That's our context. In the realms in which we make better choices, better or worse choices, in the end, that's all tempered by our morality, by what you would call the human condition. We all die, right? At least so far.
Well, that's kind of the grand crisis, isn't it? We're mortal. Like, we don't know what tomorrow holds.
Exactly. And that can send us in a few different directions. I paint it pretty black and white in the book, partly because I think too much nuance would have turned the writing into gray mush. And contrast can help clarify things. So I stuck with the rather stark idea that we're all going to die in the end, and the available paths are to either be wise or foolish. To live like our decisions are of no consequence, or that making the best choices that we can is still a better way to live.
So what sort of things would you say might be good decisions under the 21st century conditions, under the conditions we're in at the moment?
Well, from where I sit, it looks like humanity has mostly brought this on itself. I write in the book about how the good earth won't let us down as long as we tend to it. Your own scientists, your soothsayers, have been writing for ages about how climate change, massive urbanization, the proximity of humans to farm or forest animals that are vital reservoirs, could unleash microbes never seen by the humans before, and are therefore unusually lethal. Add to that an increasingly global economy, the ease of travel, the movement of refugees due to famine and wars, and these pathogens could spread around the world like bushfire. Those circumstances might be unique to this age, but the fact that we are more fragile than we would like, the fact is that we're more fragile than we would like to think, and that's nothing new. So, I would say the wiser ways are still the wiser ways. We should still focus on the same kinds of things.
Hmm. So, in my line of work, we've observed that accidents, illness, or uncertain circumstances can also trigger a sort of cascade of unexpected positive events. Those kind of circumstances, accidents, illness, all that kind of thing, they tend to channel our attention toward things we usually take for granted. There's this older hit song that says, "You don't know what you've got till it's gone." And it's often not until things break down that we start appreciating them or even noticing that they exist. I have a friend who recently had a lung condition that made it hard for them to breathe, and they talk about breathing now with a whole different sort of appreciation. Isolation has, in many instances, renewed our focus on family and friends, on our core relationships. Are those the kind of things that you're talking about when you talk about those wiser decisions?
Yeah, exactly. In the book, I talk about how important it is to value and nurture our core relationships, and also to enjoy the moment that we're in. Whether that's about our work, what we have to eat, what brings us pleasure, whether that's a tasty meal, a glass of wine, good sex, sometimes some time in the park or our garden, all of those sorts of things.
Hmm. Well, given my training, I can't help but pursue this a bit further. Anyway, we're not going to chase that too hard. You had access to a lot of pleasures by most measures. I mean, kind of whatever you wanted by way of being guided by your own appetites. You describe yourself in the book as a person who at some points went pretty far in pursuit of those embodied pleasures. Are you saying that when things get sideways, the best that we can do is kind of go like all out in our pursuit of pleasure because we never know when it's all going to go boom?
Well, lots of folks have read the book that way. And honestly, there were times in my life where I would say I tried that. I mean, you can't have a harem without someone accusing you of trying to blend reality with a different woman every day, right? But I wonder sometimes if the people that say that I think we should just jump off the cliff of hedonism have actually read some of the later chapters in the book. I'm pretty explicit about saying, yes, those things can be delightful, but they don't really solve problems that have aimed us at them in the first place. What I try to do in the later chapters is keep the tension alive, to say, yes, live in the moment and wring the most out of life, but also be aware that not just anything goes. A wise life means caring well for one another, and we can't do that if we're only thinking about ourselves and our own pleasure.
Hmm. So I find that really interesting. It seems to me that one of the good things this pandemic has reminded us of, one of those cascading events, unexpectedly positive cascading events, is that it's reminded us of our interdependence. So I feel like we're being made freshly aware of our own bodies and our health, things that we might otherwise take for granted, and also of how those things, which we might tend to think of as ours, like our health, are actually things we keep well only by caring for one another. And the disruption of things like complex chains of production, supply, and maintenance, and care, without which our societies couldn't exist, the disruption of that stuff can help us to remember that we are a global society. And it's only caring for one another that allows our species to survive at all. It's in remembering that our lives are intrinsically connected and in taking note of the fragility of the world we took for granted that we're also reminded of how precious we are to one another. And to me, that sounds like the sort of tension that you were talking about.
Yeah, yes, those are good examples of it. In my situation, I was the king of a large tribal society. I think we were more conscious of needing one another because we were under constant threat of being overrun. I got to ignore that sometimes because I had so much power and wealth, so much of what you might call privilege. But when I ignored that reality, I lost touch with one of the most important truths about living a good life, which is that we can't do it alone. Now that your society is in danger of being overrun, not by the neighboring tribe but by a virus, maybe you have some hope of recovering from what looks to me like acting like a loose collection of tribes of one.
Hmm. Tribes of one. Yeah, that's interesting. Before COVID-19 kind of mobilized our attention, the Western world was already facing an epidemic, but it was an epidemic of things like loneliness and anxiety and mental illness and uncertainty about the future. From politics gone mad to climate change, from the culture wars to the sex recession, new deaths of despair, social media feeds that exploit our mental vulnerabilities. These are all feel like they're symptoms of rampant individualism. These are things that were already ravaging our lives, you know, before COVID showed up. And in many ways, the conditions for a global panic and mental health crisis were already in place. In some ways, it feels like the pandemic itself, and this might be an untenable thought to people, but I think it's worth wrestling with. In some ways, it feels like the pandemic itself might actually be providing some antidote for some of that.
In what way? Doesn't all the isolation and distraction mean that people are more focused on themselves and less on the greater good?
Well, that's one option for sure, and obviously some people are going to go that route. They're going to use the isolation and the distancing to sort of just turn inward. But when I go out to get groceries or in other ways that have me in contact with the world outside my door, what I see more of is people sort of patiently waiting their turn, choosing to wash and disinfect their hands, perhaps to wear a mask to protect other vulnerable people, even though they're aware it doesn't protect themselves. Doing things like offering kindness and consideration to strangers, checking in on one another, taking care of their friends, delivering groceries to people that can't or shouldn't go out. And I feel like we've seen governments cooperating across typical lines of separation as well. Things like early on, China deploying doctors and health experts to help Italy, the Israelis and the Palestinians who, well, we can talk about that another time maybe, but they don't tend to cooperate. They unite to fight the epidemic. There's governments around the world that are implementing economic measures to support their vulnerable populations. You do really need to come over for like a proper dinner sometime so we can talk about that whole Middle East thing. I want to pick your brains about that.
Yeah, there's a conversation that would take a while. I'm not sure I'll live that long, actually. The whole tribalism thing, that's interesting to me. In my day, the tribe was pretty well defined. I messed with that a little bit by bringing people into the palace from all over the world, and that caused some unique problems for sure, but it seems like that would all break down in a global society.
Well, you would think so. And in some ways, that's true. Natural disasters typically bring people together and prompt spontaneous acts of solidarity among strangers. Sort of here in Winnipeg, this would be like people hopping out of their cars to push someone out of a snowbank in a blizzard, right? They don't know who's in the car, but they're just helping out. And in the past, historically, pandemics have sort of been the sad exception to that. Because people are afraid of getting infected, pandemics have fostered things like xenophobia and discrimination, conflict, competition for resources. And obviously we can see some of those things in this situation too, but I look at how the world is handling this crisis and I sort of have mixed feelings about it. Because on the one hand, I see some of those same things happening, the xenophobia, the discrimination, the competition for a medical solution to this, for a vaccination. On the other hand, I feel like in our more integrated, connected world, cooperation has also spread exponentially. And so maybe having a global common enemy could help expand our psychological boundaries so that we realize that, you know, our tribe is actually humanity rather than some more local or even hyper-local version of that idea. Maybe we can unite against a real threat without engaging in any sort of tribalistic, racist, or exclusionary action. Maybe just the taste of that possibility is why movements like Black Lives Matter have gained some ground in the midst of these wider circumstances. I can't know that, but I hope that.
Well, if you read my book, then you know I'm a bit more cynical about the self-interested nature of power, especially political power, than you seem to be. But it also makes sense to me that if we think of all of humanity as our tribe, then working to defend our tribe from a common threat might rise above our self-interests.
Well, I mean, that's when I talk about what I hope for, that's what I hope for, you know? I'm really enjoying our conversation. I feel as though we could talk for days. We've got some friends coming over later. You're welcome to stay. But before I have to go, I wanted to ask you about the ways you deal with God in the book and how that fits into what we've already been talking about. Partly I want to do this because in my own everyday experience, I feel like I'm having a lot of people who wouldn't normally even talk to me about God things, and I mean, that's kind of the part of what I do. All of a sudden I'm having these conversations with people who are like, is God responsible for this? You know, is this what? And so that's probably too big a topic for a short time, but you do kind of address it in the book. Are you open to just touching on that?
Sure. Most religious folks aren't that fond of how I've approached that part, but I would welcome a chance to explain myself a bit. What did you think I was saying?
Well, it felt to me like you were kind of vacillating. You're swinging back and forth between nothing means anything, including religion, meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. And then on the other end of the swing, I kind of felt like I heard you saying God's responsible for everything. It all sort of happens under God, and it's best not to forget that. I mean, is that fair?
That's interesting. And pretty fair as well. Since we're short on time, let me see if I can sum this up. My best shot at how God fits into all of this is that we are mostly don't know how God fits into all of this.
Atticus, the jester in the court.
Just let us finish up. Where was I?
My best shot, second line.
Yeah, my best shot to how God fits into all of this is that mostly we don't know how God fits into all of this. In fact, it might be best to say God is a word that for what is beyond our experience. Everything we can know or do somehow fits inside of that. But that doesn't make us the masters of it. Does that make sense? When I say enjoy your work, enjoy your food, enjoy your pleasure, make the most of the days you have because they are a gift from God, that's what I'm trying to say. It's important not to get too big for our britches. Religiously speaking, it's also what I was trying to get at with the more obvious poetry in chapter 3 when I say things like there's a time to embrace and a time not to embrace, which under the circumstances sounds almost eerily prescient, even though it's not what I was picturing when I wrote it.
See, that's interesting. I mean, you know, of course, that lots of folks have read it differently than that, right?
Well, of course. And on a different day, I might explain it differently, too. That's about our human limitations. We live, we die, we know less than we would like to do. We know less than we would like to think we do, and in light of all that, we should probably do the best we can with what we've got right in front of us. That's the nature of a wise life. It's not static, it's dynamic. Things change, and we have to roll with them as well as we can. In the end, that all goes better when we don't try to do it alone. The whole two is better than one, a cord of three strands is an easily broken thing.
So you're saying, so this is the point at which if we were actually had a Foley artist in the wings, the phone would ring, and I would say, oh, shoot, that's my phone. Sorry, I thought I had that on vibrate. Give me a second. Yep, that's my wife, and I was right. I need to get going. Let me just make sure I've got your contact info in here. And then I would switch back to being, you know, the Tim that I am every day. So that's the part that I wrote down and the part that Tim prepared to do. The next thing I would actually be interested to do, if Tim's open to it, is just chat for a few minutes about what we just did. Sure. And some of the ideas in there. That's all good. So, Tim, I know fan might be too strong, but you mentioned in our correspondence about this that Ecclesiastes is one of those books in the collection that has drawn you back to it, you know, kind of more than once. There's some resonance with Ecclesiastes.
Yeah. Sure.
And your character, Coeleth, is drawn from, kind of generously drawn from, perhaps, but from that text and from what's in there, and a little bit from, as well, from some of what we know about the best known of the kings of Jerusalem, David and his son Solomon, in particular Solomon. So if you think about the Coeleth character's ideas that you just read, and you think about trying to have the lens of that wisdom, and looking through the lens of that wisdom at our present 21st century circumstances, you and I experience it, as you experience it, what would you say feels like one of the most resonant ideas in Ecclesiastes for you?
I think, maybe this is just my own personality or whatever, but the sort of way that it encourages all of us to remember the good in life. So I'm the sort of person that sometimes when I'm, you know, feeling good and things seem to be great, I sort of search my brain quickly to think about all the problems, right? So,
right.
You know.
Yeah. With the other half of the glass.
Yeah, like when's the other shoe going to drop or whatever they say.
Yeah.
And so, and I struggle with that because it's ruined many, you know, great being out for dinner or things like that when all of a sudden I think, oh man, what is the check going to be?
Right, yes, yeah.
As simple
yeah.
as something like that.
instead of just, we know is going to
yeah, drop. Instead yeah. of just enjoy it. Or you know, when I'm at home and have a few minutes where I can just like sit and read and enjoy myself and then instantly start to think, oh, I got to, you know, mow the lawn or I got this coming up or I should really not be taking this time to just read for fun or whatever,
right?
Just watch a movie.
Yeah.
And yeah, so there's something to me, like I go back to that a lot. And there's larger existential issues too. Obviously, I'm talking about pretty practical things, but like there's, you know, I sort of will go out for a walk or whatever and look at the trees and then all of a sudden I think, oh, this is beautiful. And then I think, is this going to be here, you know, when my kids are grown up? Are they going to, you know, and it's been hot for the last little while. I've been noticing the grass in my neighborhood is all turning yellow because the sun is so hot. And I think, man, is this the future that we're all going to live in? So it spirals that way too,
yeah.
Like, you know, into climate change and disaster and everything else. And so what I like about Ecclesiastes is the way that it just forces you to it forces its reader to think, yeah, there's a lot going on in the world, but a lot of times sitting here and worrying about it ties into what Jesus says about the sparrow and the the sparrow, right?
Yeah. and the flowering grasses. And all these temporarily beautiful things. Things.
And just to be able to be in that moment and enjoy what's happening. So enjoy the meal that you're having, that you ordered, and you know there's money in the bank. You haven't pulled one over on the waiter. You know,
you're not going to run for the door.
Yeah, and just be there. And, you know, the same thing with, like, yes, maybe in 20 or 30 years, these trees won't grow the same way. I'm just looking, you can't see, I'm seeing the rest of the movie set here. But, you know, there's a lot of greenery in front of us. And maybe in 20, 30 years, 50 years, this won't bloom, or it'll bloom for a very short time, or whatever. But it's here now, and it's something that we can enjoy, and that doesn't mean that we don't think about what we can do, but it also doesn't mean that we get cynical or dwell on it or go into despair over it.
And it seems, I hear you about that, Tim, and I hear you about, when I listen to you describe your experiences, I mean, I resonate with lots of what you're describing as a personality and also as a dad. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've got these young adult children at our stage as a family looking to kind of start their adult lives in this uncertain time, mm-hmm. and feeling that uncertainty so acutely. It's an awkward, and when isn't it not awkward, I suppose, to kind of get it going, but there are some uniquely awkward bits to that, some really challenging parts where you kind of go, when the employers are looking at the future and going, I don't know, mm-hmm. it does create a different climate for you to be the employee, for sure, you know, some of those kind of things. And when I think about Ecclesiastes, and I think about the things that Koheleth is saying in there about their life experience, I feel like I hear those same things, right? It's mm-hmm. like, man, you know what? Like, nobody knows what tomorrow is going to be. We're all going to die, whether we're rich or poor, whether we do good or we do evil. Mm-hmm. And you know, in fact, this idea that if we do good, we're going to be rewarded with some sort of deeper sense of certainty about a long, good life, that just doesn't hold together for him philosophically and observing life at all. So he's like, in light of that, this is the moment we've got. Mm-hmm. Right? This is the moment we've got. I think Koheleth would have made an awesome Buddhist. You know, and I mean, it's why, and why not? I mean, those ideas are, you know, they're old, right? But the idea of being present to what's in front of us, to the experience we're having, and having that actually open our mind and our life and our spirit as well to what is good, including the mystery that we use God language for, the goodness of that, as well as the things about that mystery that frighten us, or that we would use awe or terror kind of language for, because we just don't know. Right, those things scare us.
Yeah. Well, I think what we only touched on a little bit was that great passage with, you know, there's time for everything.
Yeah.
Which was, of course, turned into a great song.
Yeah, the lyrics of which are almost exclusively drawn from the text. It's quite fascinating. Yeah. It's just about verbatim.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. But I think that's the other part that I try and remember, is that there is going to be a time where I will have to worry about these things very acutely, right? Whether it's...
Right. They will be the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Their money, or the environment, or, you know, future of the human race, it seems like sometimes. But to just remember for myself that this, whatever moment that I'm in, where I'm feeling drawn to have to think about those things, is not that moment, right?
Right.
This is the time to, you know, this is the time to enjoy, that will be the time to think about it, or whatever, right? And so, I know for me... even just through this whole thing, working at home, and I've been working from home as a person for a while, there's even some wisdom in there about how you manage your time, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, this is the evening now, it's 5 o'clock, even though I may not feel like I can put my work away, I have to, and spend time with, you know, and the lines are all blurred, obviously, these days.
But, yeah, working from home does that.
Yeah.
Big time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, with both of us working from home and both kids at home, I mean, it's just sort of, yeah, it's hard to say, okay, I'm going to work until this time, but it is important, right? And I think that goes for everything in life, that there's a time to go out in the streets and march and protest, and there's a time to not, there's a time to hide in your house and because there's a pandemic going on, and there's a time to recharge before you can go back out and do that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I think that's the important, those are the two keys that I always take away from Ecclesiastes. So.
Well, I gave Koheleth that line from the third chapter where that poem is, about the time, a time to embrace and a time not to embrace, because it just felt like a quite a literal line in the poem about some of what we're struggling with, even in terms of touch in our culture, right?
Yeah. Like maybe we're too close right now.
Well, we let you into the house. I think
but that's, that bridge. I mean, that was an interesting thing when we came here this morning. We haven't seen each other in real life in 6 months, five months.
Yeah.
And I'm not really a big hugger, but, you know, when I haven't seen someone for a while, but it's this awkward of like, no, we can't.
Well, and Jane said, I mean, very sensitively, like we're standing outside because we came out to just greet you guys. And she said, like, are we going into the house? I mean, these are questions that we wouldn't have asked a few months ago. You know, we had a service person here to do some mowing in these adjacent empty lots and needed to discuss where the, you know, where the boundary markers were. and normally if I meet somebody like that, I would shake their hand.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And he kind of reaches out his gloved hand to me like this. He says, well, we can do this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm allowed to do this, I think is what he said. Yeah. Or something to that nature. Something that said, we've discussed this. You know, we've navigated this as as staff in this business, and this is, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
And so we're constantly negotiating this stuff. And it kind of feels like in some ways we're sort of moving in and out of moments. To me, like we're present, we want to be present to one another, but we're not sure how to do that. The previous rules of how to engagement do not apply, you know, at least not uniformly. Yeah. And it makes us feel like we're off balance all the time as people.
Yeah.
Like we're having to renegotiate things we thought were negotiated and settled already.
Yeah.
And that's a hard space to live well in.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Koleth also talks about caring, he talks about the good earth, and again, we just touched on it in the script and didn't expand it, but you were talking about, you know, the trees and all that kind of stuff. I was at the local, you know, dump here the other day, dropping off yet another load of brush. It's amazing how much work it is to keep a, you know, sort of a natural space from running away with everything. Because nature, and the guy at the dump, you know, obviously has some trees as well, and so we were having this conversation about elms and their voracious appetite to, you know, take over the world. Maple trees, they'll just seed everywhere, and how they can feel like, they feel like a weed when you don't want them there, and they feel like this beautiful thing when you do. And that made me think about how we do anything. You know, I look out the window of this space, and I've commented on it lots of times in the live stream, because it's really beautiful. It's just like looking out on this, these wild prairie grasses and these trees. It's lovely, you know. And I know that if I don't deal with all the little maples that pop up in there, you know, that's not what I'm going to be looking at a couple years from now.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a problem. And so it's even an ordinary thing like that. How do I look at that seedling in that moment? Depends so much on my perspective. Is this something I desire? Is this something I want to sort of take into me? Or is this something I need to put away or pull up or set aside? Or So it's kind of like that sense of being off balance or having to constantly negotiate what space am I in this moment.
Yeah.
That's true in life anyway, but we don't tend to think about it in our ordinary activities.
Right.
But we're noticing it now in our extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah.
Which I think is what the Siggy character was trying to get at when they were like, you know what, one of the potentially good things to come out of a pandemic experience like this might be that we start to pay attention to things we would otherwise just take for granted.
Yeah.
Including, from Koleth's perspective, ordinary things like our work. I don't think I've ever felt more grateful to be employed, you know, to have work that was remunerative.
Yeah.
Because it's never a given, but all of a sudden it's wildly not a given.
Yeah.
It's globally not a given.
Yeah.
On a huge scale. And so my gratitude for that feels like, although I know the idea of gratitude is that it shouldn't be circumstantial, there's a part of it that is affected by circumstance.
Right.
And even if I choose to be a grateful-hearted person, when something good comes my way, that stirs that up.
Right.
You know, and I'm freshly grateful for work or friendship or the ability to negotiate the moment of at the door. Are we coming in or are we not coming in with people where there's good faith and there's friendship and history, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what a gift.
Like, yeah.
To be able to not have to actually do this alone.
Right.
Like, that's... I feel like Koleth would say that's as good as it gets.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't be selling things short or saying life is not good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a complex good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, thanks. Thanks for dropping by and hanging with us this morning. Tim, thank you for being willing to read my writing. You may have a chance to exact your own, you know, toll for that at some point. Feel free. But I appreciate it. It's been fun to do it with you. Yeah. And good to be with everybody.